Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And yes, it's our family meeting on Making It today. So far, we've heard the 10-year-olds and their parents defining a successful 10-year-old. We've heard some 20 and 30-somethings saying what markers of success they need in a lover to consider marrying that person. So let's move on to midlife and beyond. You might be the CEO or a vice president or the department chairman at the top of your career. Or maybe it didn't quite work out that way, like in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I had it all planned out. First, he'd take over the history department. Then when Daddy retired, he'd take over the whole college, you know? That was the way it was supposed to be. Getting angry, baby, huh? That was the way it was supposed to be. All very simple. And Daddy thought it was a good idea, too, for a while. Until he started watching for a couple of years. Getting angry? Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. That maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff. That maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great big fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
Oh, it's exhausting just hearing 45 seconds of that. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That'll get you depressed at any age. But if you're 50 plus and the dreams didn't quite come true and you realize some things are no longer possible, how do you adjust to the limits of your professional life? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you're 50 plus, how do you accept or not the limits on your professional life? 212-433-9692. Whether you are the CEO but wanted to be president of the United States, hello, Mitt, how's life these days? Or whether you're the long time or in a stable job but with not much upward mobility, or whether you're the frustrated, unemployed dad in glory days. Bruce Springsteen from Glory Days, the last line there, the glory days he ain't never had, as the lyric goes. So if you're 50 plus and the dreams didn't quite come true, or some of them did, but some of them never will, and you realize some things are no longer possible, or you believe they're not, how do you adjust to the limits in your life? 212-433-WNYC. And with us now, as your calls are coming in, is Janet Taylor, a life coach and a psychiatrist practicing community mental health here in New York City, and a contributor to the AARP's Life Reimagined project. Dr. Taylor, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian.
You get depressed when you hear that Springsteen song?
I don't get depressed when I hear the Springsteen song, but I think the point is your professional life is not the only place that you can have success, and sometimes there are other avenues where if your job's not working out well, you can still find purpose and find potential, and that's the point.
Sure. But you have a Michael Jordan quote on your site: I can accept failure, I can't accept not trying. And I assume you have that as a motivational tool to get people to try more. But I think the first part of that is at least as difficult. I can accept failure. Well, I don't know if Michael Jordan can accept failure so much, but why did you feature that quote? And do you think about the first half?
Of course I think about the first half. And in reality, if you are extending yourself, if you're giving, you're not going to make it all the time. And I think that what Michael Jordan, I mean, even he, you know, didn't win every championship every year for his life. But the fact is, sometimes when you are working hard, you might hit a closed door, but you still have to get up and practice and work harder. And I think that certainly exemplified his work ethic. And I think it exemplifies the work ethic of a lot of other people, because if we all succumb to when we didn't make it, then why try at all? And that's not our spirit, that's not the American spirit, and sometimes I think we all have to be reminded of that.
So how do you coach people, how do you counsel people as a life coach, as a psychiatrist, to accept failure or accept limitations to their dreams after they have tried?
Well, again, I mean, I think when you, anytime something happens in your life, and you always have a perspective, and most of us learn the most when we're disappointed or when we have failed. So the key is to examine what happened, to pay attention to your emotions, pay attention to your feelings, and see if you can anticipate, readjust, work harder, work differently, so that the next time, and invariably, unfortunately, we get other chances to work things out, that you're prepared the second time around.
Let's hear some stories. Deborah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was always going to be the great artist, and I became a graphic designer after doing photography. And then in 2004, my father died. I inherited a building, and I became a landlady. And in the same time, print was dying, which is what I did. So I thought, well, if I can run this building, I can have the time to do my own work. And it was kind of the hardest thing I ever did. It was swimming with sharks. It still can be swimming with sharks. It's not anything that I knew. It was the school of hard knocks. But I'm really happy, and I'm able to do my own work, which has nothing to do with graphic design or photography. It's ceramics, and actually it's all related because it's all art. But anyway, I was hoping to be like a famous Massimo Vignelli-like kind of person, and it never happened, but it's okay.
Did you have
Did
you have to find a different part of your soul, sort of, in order to get fulfilled as a landlord when you thought you were going to be the big graphic designer?
Yeah, I had to get really tough, and that was really, really hard for me. I had to really, like, not be nice, not defer, not, you know, and it was, like, without... You know, it was really hard. It was really hard, and but it was so concrete. And my father had always said, "You're not tough enough," and I never knew what he meant, and now I do.
Deborah, thanks a lot. Great story,
like what,
Janet.
It sounds like what Deborah did was she went in knowing that she had to make room for that creative side of herself. And although it didn't turn out that, you know, she did ceramics instead of something else, I think being mindful about that part of you as you enter in, whether it's a job or whether it's even different passions, is so important to keep track of.
Anne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Tell us your story.
Well, I'm 60, and when I was 24, I began to pursue a career as a performing artist. My contribution to this conversation is that, like so many, I taught for many years. Actually, I've been teaching for last 16 years. You know, who teaches voice, who teaches acting, who teaches dance. I was teaching dance. This year I gave it up. I said, that's it, no more. Because at this age, I didn't become depressed to be 60 in January. But I did realize that, you know, it's time to stop doing the things that I thought were going to be just for now, temporary, just until blah, blah, blah. I realized that until is not coming, and that I should stop doing the things that I really don't want to do now, now or never. And luckily, luckily I also didn't make much money at it because I happened to teach tap dance. That's like the worst thing to try to teach in the world, but especially in Italy where I went. But luckily I did discover, out of desperation, I discovered busking. So I sort of have realized that, you know, performing artists try constantly to define themselves. What the heck are you? Are you a dancer? I have decided at 60, and it's sticking, this thought. I am an entertainer, and I have decided to devote myself to busking because that has really worked for me, and I've had to give up Well, I'm glad to give up a lot of the other things that I tried to do. It just wasn't me that I was trying to join tribes that I'm not that tribe.
How much did you struggle with teaching? I'm thinking of an old movie called The Competition, which is about concert pianists. And the one who wasn't going to make it or was going to give it up for family life or something like that had kind of this vision where he saw somebody who was getting by making it as a piano teacher of little kids. And the way the film depicted it, it was the dreariest possible existence to go from concert pianist to piano teacher of children. So do you struggle with that? You know, the old cliche, the mean cliche, those who can't do teach. Did you struggle with that, and were you able to find peace with it as a teacher?
You know, I discovered this is just me because I have a lot of colleagues who teach. I realized that I want to study. I don't want to teach.
Yeah. You want to learn.
I wanted to study. I want to learn. And teaching did not give me any time to learn.
Uh-huh.
I also realized that, it was really, I taught for 16 years, and it's really dreary teaching the same things over and over, especially for a dancer,
uh-huh.
The same movements over and over. I mean, it's so counter-creative.
And thank you very much for your call. Janet Taylor, that raises some difficult realities, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But, you know, Dr. Laura Carstensen at Stanford writes about how aging reminds us that we don't have all the time in the world left to get it right and to get it right. And it sounds like Anne, your last caller, said she knew until wasn't coming and she was going to make decisions that were right for her.
Our family meeting on Making It on The Brian Lehrer Show right now, talking with people who are 50-plus on how you adjusted or not to the limits of your dreams as they were presenting themselves in your lives. John in Paramus, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Yes, Brian. I had a business for 22 years, and it was very successful, and I would have liked to kept it going, but in the last few years, the economic conditions forced me to really to sell it. But, you know, I concentrate on the positive things I did for my business and the people who worked for me. I provided a salary for people. I provided jobs for people for 22 years. I never missed a payroll. And I provided great service. I may not have been the number one in the industry in my area or anything else like that, but I concentrated on that stuff. That I didn't go out on my own terms, but I concentrated on the stuff that I did well, like providing a service and providing employment for people for 22 years.
Thank you very much, John. So when you start making those compromises, your dreams for a little improvement on reality, as we've heard from a couple of folks, how do you adjust? Did anyone see the movie Up in the Air and this scene where George Clooney lays off a guy?
Your resume says that you minored in French culinary arts. Most students there were going to fry her at KFC, but you bust tables at Il Picador to support yourself. And then you get out of college and you come and you work here. How much did they first pay you to give up on your dreams?
$27,000 a year.
And when were you going to stop and come back and do what makes you happy?
Good question.
I see guys who work at the same company for their entire lives, guys exactly like you. They clock in, they clock out, and they never have a moment of happiness. You have an opportunity here, Bob. This is a rebirth. Now, if not for you, do it for your children.
How about that line, Janet Taylor? How much did they pay you to give up on your dreams?
I love that. I love that. And I also like the fact that you said this is a rebirth. And I think the point is, you know, we put so much focus on happiness, but a sense of purpose and finding your passion and dreams trumps happiness all the time. But it's up to you individually to figure it out.
Judy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Sorry, I had to get you off speaker.
Sure.
I'm a violist, and I play in the New York Philharmonic, which certainly if you had told me in my childhood when I was a lousy violinist that I would reach that level, I would have never believed you. And what I found was that there is no time when you're going up the rung of achieving more and more professionally. There's no time when it's enough. You get to a certain point and you think, oh, that's really great, and a couple of days later it's not enough. And I realized, thanks to breaking both my arms a few years ago in a mountaineering accident.
Whoa.
And coming very close to losing my career.
A violist with two broken arms.
Yeah, it was not good. I'm actually, the reason I'm home is because my left arm is in a cast after yet another surgical procedure to try to regain the range of motion that one needs to do the unnatural act of playing the viola. And in a way, this has been, in a weird way, a blessing, because it has kind of put full stop to that incessant craving for more. And I mean, of course, it's not full stop. Of course, I want to do anything that anybody else is doing. I want to do better. And
but did it change not just what you thought you could do as a violist, at least in the short term, but change your outlook on life?
It did. It really did. I'm just happy to be able to play. I'm happier than I've ever been with my job at the Philharmonic. It has its shortcomings. In the dressing room, we're always complaining, and then we say, shut up, you're effing lucky to have this job. In fact, we have effing lucky parties on tour sometimes. But
and you never want your boss to say that, right?
No,
you don't want the conductor to come out and say,
right,
you're effing lucky to have this job.
Right.
Just remember, you're one of, 100 people in the orchestra.
Right. No, fortunately, the conductor is tactful enough not to say that. He also knows that that would be a very unwise thing to do.
Yeah.
But he's lucky to have us. But it really, it's more comfortable now.
Did you ever find that your ambition to do more, better, faster got in the way of your love of the music?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. When you are thinking in terms of perfection is satisfactory and everything else is not satisfactory, it takes away from that just being in the music. If you're, I mean, ideally you work as hard as you can technically, and then when you perform, you just let yourself go and you're there in the music. But
and yet if you're going to make it as a violist at the level of the New York Philharmonic, and I know a lot of people in conservatory and people in your world, you have to be striving for perfection, like from the time you're six.
You do. Actually, for me, it was 10. But you do have to be striving for perfection. But, you know, it's there comes into play a sort of a Zen thing where you have to be non-attached. And it is really easy to say and really hard to do, because very, very few people are going to play perfectly. I mean, there are a few rarefied individuals in solo careers who occasionally play unbelievably, you know, you could say flawlessly. But that's not for most of us. And, you know, you spend all your time, perfection is basically looking at the warts.
And I guess even for you as a violist, the pinnacle of what a musician could hope to attain on one level playing with the New York Philharmonic, the way you broke your arm says something about you, because you went out on your free time and tried to climb mountains.
Well, I've done that since I was 20,
so.
And I love it. But, my mantra is now that I can't fall down anymore.
Judy, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank
great,
you.
Great
pleasure.
Call. And Jay in Hillsdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
I'm good. Love your show.
Thank you.
For me, it's just I'm at a time where I'm, trying to work out a second act in my life, and I'm thinking about, I'm living with so much regret. It's so distracting. It distracts me during the day. It distracts me at night. And I'm remembering things that I had buried for so long. When I was in high school, the administrators exchanged my SAT scores with another student. And, they had tried to sort of help me. They obtained a presidential scholarship for me, and they tried to help me with, achieve my goal of going to an Ivy League school. But it didn't work out, and I ended up going to a state school. And now I'm sort of, I was I had fashion for a while, and now I'm doing something else. And I'm thinking back, and it's causing such distraction for me. I'm not present with my family.
Because you're thinking about what might have been that isn't going to happen. Andrea Taylor, as a life coach, as a community psychiatrist in New York City, talk to Jay.
Well, I mean, Jay, it sounds like, you may have some guilt, but that you need to deal with, and that kind of distinguishes needing a life coach, somebody to move you forward, versus maybe even therapy to help deal with whatever's holding you back so that you can move forward to what you want. I mean, I went to a state school too. It's not, that may not be the issue, but the fact is there's something in Life Reimagined called repacking, which means what do you need to let go of to move forward? And if you're distracted and not present for your family and feeling unfulfilled, it sounds like there's a lot that you need to deal with so that you can accept where you are and maximize every single day of the rest of your life. I mean, you still have time to achieve something that you'd like to, but if you're going to hold back and be stuck, then you're just spinning your wheels.
Yes, I agree. I do. I would like to, to do something, despite, the things that what's happened in my life. And I would like to not think about these things. I've actually buried them for so long, and now it's sort of coming to the fore. And I'm thinking about them over and over again. I'm like,
here's a suggestion. Write down everything that keeps coming up for you, everything that you did, every feeling that you had, and literally write it down on a piece of paper, do a ritual, truly bury it somewhere, and move on.
No, that's what my wife suggests that I do. I have been writing it down.
But write it down and have a ritual and get rid of it. You mentioned the word bury it.
What's a ritual?
Burn it. Let it go and figure out what's next.
What
for
kind
you.
Of ritual? Make up a ritual for us, Janet.
For me?
Yeah.
So, if you've written it down, get a clean piece of paper, write it down, use your favorite saying, and go out and actually, I don't know if you want to burn a candle, if you just want to make it simpler, and bury it and say, from this day forward, I will no longer think about things that I did unless they make me better, and I'm going to move forward to and have two other things that you're going to work on. And not just say in your head, but, if your goal is to, be a better guitar player, if you do that, you're going to do that and take some lessons. So you identify a goal, have an action plan, but the whole point is to move forward and truly let go of what's holding you back. Because what's holding you back is yourself, period.
As they say in Frozen, let it go. But easier said than done. Jay, good luck. I'm just thinking about the way he framed that in part about trying to aspire to an Ivy League school early on and having to settle for a state school is emblematic of something. I went to a state school too, by the way. But... But I'm thinking of this in terms of class. I know you've been at Harlem Hospital. You're here in New York.
Right.
You see the very rich around you, and you see the people who will never be rich and never had that expectation. Do you think growing up in poverty makes people view success in certain ways, like more materialistic or less materialistic? I'm thinking, for example, of people who are or maybe used to be labeled nouveau riche, come from nothing and make it into money, maybe being more likely to flaunt it with fancy cars, fancy bling, whatever, more than people who might have grown up having more than most. Do you know what I'm getting at?
I do, but my experience has been that when you are in poverty, your focus is on survival.
Yeah.
And that survival takes on many different meanings. And not only do people around you have less expectation, but resources, schools, jobs, other institutions have less expectations for you too. And I have never met a poor person who did not want to do better. Have never met one. But it's a matter of opportunity. It's a matter of resources. It's a matter of someone saying, you can do this. And I think that is the irony about what happens to people who do not have resources. On the flip side, I mean, I raised my girls in Westchester and have been exposed in numerous ways to people who definitely have more means and sometimes may not have the motivation because things come too easily. It's about this ratio of success to expectation and then the preparation in terms of for people who have limited means, education basically is the only way. But I think we have to lose this notion as a society that people who live in poverty are not motivated and don't have any expectations, because they do, but it really is a matter of resources and people expecting more of them.
Janet Taylor, community psychiatrist in New York City, life coach, and a contributor to the AARP's Life Reimagined Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.